This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. You may have gone through a period in your life similar to the one described in the new film Frances Ha, co-written by our first guests Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach. It stars Gerwig as Frances, a 27-year-old single woman who graduated from college a few years earlier, but still doesn't act or feel like an adult. Noah Baumbach directed the film. They previously worked together on the film Greenberg, which Baumbach also directed and co-wrote, and Gerwig starred in opposite Ben Stiller. Gerwig's other films include To Rome with Love, Damsels in Distress, and Baghead. Baumbach also directed Kicking and Screaming, The Squid and the Whale, and Margot at the Wedding. They spoke with Terry last Tuesday. When Frances Ha begins, Frances is living with her best friend from college, Sophie. Frances wants to be a dancer, but she's not progressing at the company where she's an apprentice. Sophie works in publishing. In this scene, Frances asks Sophie to retell what they call the story of us.
Tell me the story of us.
Again? All right, Frances. We are going to take over the world.
You'll be this awesomely bitchy publishing mogul.
And you'll be this famous modern dancer, and I'll publish a really expensive book about you.
The D-bags we make fun of will put on their coffee tables.
And we'll co-own a vacation apartment in Paris.
And we'll have lovers.
And no children.
And we'll speak at college graduations.
And honorary degrees.
So many honorary degrees.
When Frances's boyfriend Dan suggests that she move in with him, Frances insists she has to stay with Sophie, with whom she shares the lease to their apartment. Frances breaks up with her boyfriend, but soon after, she's stunned when Sophie tells her she's moving to another apartment.
Are you okay with it? I really don't want to do it if you're not okay with it.
I kind of thought that we were going to renew our lease.
Yeah, but we never talked about it.
I could have moved in with Dan.
Not if you broke up.
That's why we broke up.
Really?
No.
We could always look for a place together if you want. Yeah, but it's really hard to find stuff in Tribeca.
I can't afford Tribeca.
I'm not leaving you. I'm just moving neighborhoods.
That's a scene from Frances Ha. Noah Baumbach, Greta Gerwig, welcome to Fresh Air. The movie is about that transitional period after college, before you really feel like an adult, before you have an income, a profession, a home, maybe a family. But you're probably approaching this from different perspectives. Greta Gerwig, let me start with you. You're about the same age as the character in your late 20s. What are some of the complications of that period of life that you've experienced that you wanted to portray in the film?
Well, I think for me, the period of life right after college, there's kind of a grace period where being a mess is charming and interesting. And then I think when you hit around 27, it stops being charming and interesting and it starts being kind of pathological and you have to find a new way of life. Otherwise you're going to be in a place where the rest of your peers have been moving on and you're stuck. But
you've been making movies for several years, so I'm thinking, like, how bumpy could that ride have been for you?
Well, I think that anybody who does anything in the arts feels very close to failure because it seems like it's so possible to not be doing it because even when things are going well, it feels like they're always about to fall apart and about to not work. And so it's also, she's in an emotional place where I think I definitely went through where she's realizing her friends aren't her family, which is difficult.
Can you just say a few words about what that was like? I think a lot of people go through that, thinking that their friends are their family and their friends understand them better. Their friends understand things that their family would never understand and that they'll always be with these friends.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're in college particularly, there's not a lot of boundaries, and you leave your family and then you go instantly form a new family of friends, and then that carries on into your early and mid-20s, and then suddenly when people start coupling off in a very serious way or rightly choosing selfish things over groupthink, At that point in life, if you're not there yet, it's traumatic because you're watching these people around you make decisions for themselves and what they need as opposed to what is the group doing. And I think high school students, I'm not saying college students don't understand this movie, but I think high school students get it, and I think adults get it. But I think what's interesting is when you show it to college students, none of them really believe that's going to happen to them. They think that their friends and their lives will be the exception to this rule, and that they will stay as close as they are, and it'll never happen to them. And I feel like they're almost incapable of seeing into the future and realizing that, like, you will love each other, but it will not be in the same way.
Would you have been in that category in college?
Completely. I mean, I would have been in that category way after college. I really, I extended that period of thinking we would all live in a house for far too long.
Noah Baumbach, let me bring you into the conversation. You're approaching the characters in the movie from different generations and from different genders. Noah, you're in your 40s. Greta, you're in your 20s. Noah, you're a man, and Greta, you're a woman. and Noah, this is the third time you've made a movie that relates to that transitional period in a young person's life. Your first two films, Kicking and Screaming and Mr. Jealousy, were about people in that period. In fact, what I want to do is play a clip of an interview you and I did in 1998 after Mr. Jealousy. And so here's an excerpt of that interview. So this is me and Noah Baumbach in 1998. Your first two films, Kicking and Screaming and Mr. Jealousy, are about that period of almost limbo after college when you're not quite a fully formed adult yet. You don't have like a full life of your own yet, but you're not really a student anymore either. So right. It's that in-between period where you don't know exactly what you're going to become. You don't know if you'll be successful at pursuing the thing that you want to pursue, if you're lucky enough to know what it is you want to pursue yet. Why does that particular transitional period interest you? I guess it's in part because of your age. Still being in your 20s, yes?
Right, 28. I'm interested in how sort of friendships or relationships that have developed over a long period of time, when people go through times of sort of individual change. And in Kicking and Screaming, it's a group dynamic, how that group dynamic changes when each of them individually have to sort of move on. Do they end the friendships? How do the friendships change? And that was sort of a big thing that interested me in that movie. With Kicking and Screaming, it was people who had graduated college and they just didn't want life to happen to them. They wanted no experience. They wanted to stay where they were. And with Mr. Jealousy, it's people who now have had some experience, and I think now they're afraid that nothing will happen to them, and they want as much experience as possible, so they create these kind of neurotic adventures for themselves to somehow inject adventure into their lives.
Okay, so that was Noah Baumbach recorded in 1998, and now Noah Baumbach with my other guest, Greta Gerwig, has co-written and he's directed the new film Frances Ha, which has a similar theme. So, Noah, how has your take on that period of life in your 20s after college, before you found who it is you are as an adult and what you're going to be doing, how has your take on that changed?
Well, I've stopped using the phrase inject in adventure. other than that, I was okay with how I sounded. well, it's interesting because what I didn't exactly know then is that I think I was really going through a lot of... I was not injecting enough adventure into my life at the time, or too much adventure. I was about to sort of go into a period of my life that was of kind of, I think, vast individual change. It was a long period after Mr. Jealousy in my next movie. And so when I hear that clip, that's what I'm thinking about, is sort of that I was sort of about to begin that, and I think change a lot personally and also change as a filmmaker. But all that said, here we are talking about the same time in life in another movie. And I think, you know, I mean, I was interested in making this movie because of Greta, so I was shoehorned into the age of 27 because that's what she is. But, you know, I even the movies I've made that aren't about people in their late 20s, The Squid and the Whale and Greenberg and Margot at the Wedding, I think all are sort of essentially about transition and about squaring who you want to be with who you actually are.
I think a lot of people will have experienced the awkwardness of this moment that you portray in the film, where Frances is living with two men in their 20s, and then one of them keeps bringing dates home and taking you know, the woman he's brought home into his bedroom. And she's like, she's the girl living in this house with two guys. So it's there's something just so inherently awkward about that for her.
Yeah, I mean, it's not emphasized in the movie, but Noah and I talked about when we were writing that section, like, when is the last time in life that you can ask someone, do you want to see my room? And we thought that that was so funny, because it's so childlike to tell someone, you want to see my room? And you start saying it maybe when you're 4, and, like, you should stop saying it by the time you're 27. And that was kind of like, we thought, I don't know that anybody even notices that joke. But I think a lot of the movie involves, like, that when is the, like, that you don't know when the last time of something happening is. You just know when it's over. Like, the opening sequence is this, like, glorious day between her and Sophie. And this idea of, like, you don't know what the last great day you'll spend with your best friend is. You just know when you've never had that day again. And that, anyway, the bringing the girls into the room was, like, about that sort of, I mean, it's terribly awkward, and but I sort of liked the way Frances dealt with it, which was that in her, I think I always thought that she decided in her mind that she would be the cool, friendly lady roommate who would be really cool with all these girls coming over and shake their hands and learn their names, and that she would be the hip girl on the inside who doesn't have to have a sexual relationship with these guys, and that she's going to be magnanimous to the women coming in and out of this apartment.
were you ever in that position?
I might have been. I have a lot of male friends who I really like, and I've always enjoyed the feeling of, like, this sounds probably really, I've always enjoyed the feeling of, like, I'll never sleep with you. And you'll never have that power over me, and we'll never have that relationship. And I get to meet all the people who have to deal with what you cry about at night, and I will never have to do that.
And I can tell those girls, oh, you're really pretty.
Yeah, exactly. Or I was not a cool girl in junior high or high school who had friends who were boys, and I think I figured it out when I was in college, and I've, for some reason, that's been a hobby of mine ever since. But I was, in junior high and high school, I couldn't figure it out, and then it clicked all of a sudden, and I was like, you just have to be really nice to them. And then and you have to tell them they're right about stuff, and that their thoughts are really smart, and just treat them like they're the best ones in the room, and they'll really like you.
So have you had girlfriends who you were as close to as Frances is to Sophie?
Yeah, I went to women's college. I went to Barnard. So that's kind of a breeding ground for beautiful, messed up female friendships. And so I had a lot of them. I mean, I had a real group of girls that I was very, very much, there were six of us, but so it wasn't like I just had one, but I loved them a lot, and we lived together after college.
So this is your alternate family?
This is my alternate family, and we really did. I had a fantasy that we were going to start a checking account for a fund that we would all buy a house together. This was my fantasy, and it never happened. We never started a fund for a house together. But I don't know. I guess I've always felt like if there's a way to live as a family with your friends, that would be the good thing to do. But I don't think anybody else feels that way.
Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Their new film, Frances Ha, is now out in limited theaters. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach. They co-wrote the new film, Frances Ha. He directed it, and she stars as Frances, a 27-year-old single woman who's still having problems making the transition from college to adulthood.
Greta Gerwig, your character of Frances is a dancer. Do you dance? Do you have a dance background?
I grew up dancing. I did a lot of ballet. I loved ballet. And then I did other kinds of dance as well. But I never was a dancer. I was never professional.
I read that you fenced also.
Yeah.
Was that in college?
No, I actually fenced in high school after, junior high and high school after I had kind of a painful experience with ballet. I think that a lot of girls do that are not quite right for it. And my body wasn't quite right for it, but I loved it so intensely. And I was so heartbroken when it seemed like I would never really be a professional ballet dancer. But there was actually a fencing place in Sacramento that had opened up right after I stopped dancing. And my mom read in the newspaper, the Sacramento Bee, that dancers make good fencers because they have quick feet. And so I started, she signed me up, and I loved it instantly. And I competed a lot, and I was pretty good, mainly because I was just insanely competitive and really tall. So those things help with fencing.
It's funny, I was going to make a joke about how not useful fencing is. But if this was a few decades ago and you had just signed on to the MGM studio, they'd be teaching you how to fence, if you were a guy anyways. I'm not sure if you were a girl, if they'd
right.
be teaching you how to fence.
I mean, looking back at my childhood, I didn't have a thing of like, I'm going to be an actor, but looking at all of the activities that I took on, they all had a theatrical component to them that I really... I loved fencing so much, and then I had my birthday, my 15th birthday at the Renaissance Pleasure Fair, and I made my friends dress up in Renaissance clothes and then watch me fence. It was really weird, but it was really sweet. My mom got all these costumes for everyone, so because there were all these theatrical things I was doing, even though they weren't directly theater or acting.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig, and they collaborated on the new film Frances Ha. And now you also worked together on Greenberg, which, Noah, you wrote and directed, and Greta Gerwig, you starred with Ben Stiller. Let's hear a scene from Greenberg. And the film's about, Ben Stiller plays a guy in his 40s who's had a nervous breakdown, has just gotten out of a psychiatric institution, and is going from New York to L.A. to basically house sit for his brother and sister-in-law. And Greta Gerwig plays this couple's personal assistant. So Ben Stiller and Greta Gerwig, end up meeting and spending time together at the brother's house. And then he goes over to her place for a drink. They start awkwardly kissing, and then she kind of puts a stop to things, and here's how it goes.
Can we take it slow? I'm sorry, it's just that I just got out of a long relationship, and I don't want to go from just having sex to just having sex to just having sex.
Who's the third just having sex?
You, if we had sex.
Okay, then who's the second?
The guy I met at this gallery thing.
You slept with him?
Yeah, I did.
How'd that go?
What do you mean, the sex?
Yeah, well,
it was pretty awkward.
A short scene from Greenberg. Was that all written, or was some of that improvised?
That was all written.
Greta, your character, Florence in Greenberg, is so unsure of herself and unsure what she wants for herself. And it's so interesting, like, you've described yourself back when you were a competitive fencer in high school as being like super competitive, and the character you play in that is just the opposite of that. Like, she doesn't really usually know how to push back or what she wants.
Yeah, Florence was really hard. I mean, I loved Florence, and I felt like when I read the script I instantly understood her, and even how she held herself or how she drove a car, I felt like I understood the parts of her body that she didn't like. And I don't know, there was something about her that I felt instantly this deep empathy with her. But playing her, I didn't purposefully try to method act or anything, but I think characters get under my skin, and I felt very vulnerable the whole time we were making the movie and very unable to stand up for myself. And it was a hard time because she's so exposed. She's like a bug without a shell or something. She doesn't have anything to protect herself, and that's how I felt.
It's interesting that you said you knew the parts of her body that she didn't like. I bet that's not in the script, but how did, like, what parts of her body didn't she like? And how did that help you, knowing that?
I felt like she had skirts that were too small and she could feel her thighs rubbing together when she walked. I don't know how I knew that, but I knew, and I knew that she was too tired to really do anything about. I'm actually, as I'm talking about it, I get emotional about her. I could feel her not looking at herself in a mirror because she would know it would make her sad. And there's something about that that I understood, and I felt like it would make her tuck herself in a way, to try to protect herself, but she can't.
You're saying that as if you really understand what it's like to have those kind of body issues, but I wouldn't think that you would have had them yourself.
I mean, I don't know that any woman gets out of life without having some body issues. I mean, I had, I think a lot of teenage girls go through this, is when you turn about 15, you gain weight in ways that you didn't know was possible suddenly because you're going through puberty. And I never was overweight, but I went through a period of time where I was bigger, and then when I was in college, right before my senior year, I lost an incredible amount of weight due to chain smoking and really poor personal behavior, and it felt so wonderful, and I wished it didn't feel as wonderful as it does, and it felt like liberating, and I felt great about myself, and people asked me, did you get a haircut? And I was like, no, I lost 25 pounds, you idiot. But I think it also gave me the confidence to kind of go make these movies and do all this stuff, because I felt like I was high on some kind of thinness. And then when I read the part of Florence, I almost felt ashamed, because I felt like I had been trying to run away from being that person because I thought that that's what I had to do to make movies. And then when I read that part, I gained 15, 17, 20 pounds for the part, because I knew that was right. And I've never really lost it after that. I just kind of stayed that weight. But I think there was, it was like when I read the script, I understood it, and I also felt like, oh, you didn't have to try to be another person to make art or to be an actress. You can be this person, and someone will want to tell that story.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us so much. Greta Gerwig, Noah Baumbach, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Gerwig and Baumbach co-wrote the new film Frances Ha. She stars in it. He directed it. You can find the full interview at our website, freshair.npr.org. The rock band Dawes has just released its third album called Stories Don't End. The band has cited Neil Young and Crosby, Stills, and Nash among its influences, and rock critic Ken Tucker says the new Dawes album illustrates the band's link to an earlier era of rock. Here's his review.
Told most of all, like a feather that finds its invisible path as it falls. Just beneath the surface.
If you heard that song and said, somebody's been listening to their old Jackson Browne albums, you're not exactly insulting Dawes. This band has actually backed Browne on tour, and Browne has sung backup on at least one of their songs. So you could say they come by their riffs, licks, and phrasing honestly. You could, that is, if you wanted to pigeonhole this quartet as a throwback to Southern California 70s soft rock, which would be a mistake. Why, on the very next cut on their new album Stories Don't End, they sound like East Coast 70s soft rock on the Steely Danish From a Window Seat.
I buckle in my seatbelt and plug my headset in a chair. And to the music I watch flight attendants move. They are pointing at the exit, but it looks more like a prayer. Or an ancient dance their bloodline reaches through. These planes are good for sifting through the warriors from the men. I get time to sit and watch them for a while. You can see everywhere they're going.
I kid Dawes about their influences. I kid because I like the way these boys carry those influences with their own good humor and with a loose assurance that their distinctiveness will shine through. On the lovely title song, Stories Don't End, singer-songwriter-guitarist Taylor Goldsmith talks about the ineffectiveness of talk, how words cannot express all that he wants to say about the woman he's describing, the feelings he has for her. For that, he requires not only words, but the slightly fuzzy timbre of his voice and the gentle drumming of his brother, Griffin Goldsmith. He gets closer in this way to suggesting how complex a story one song can tell. Because, as the title reminds us, the stories of a relationship, once launched, don't end. We impose a narrative, a beginning, middle, and end, upon them.
From the paper umbrella in both of our dreams, shadows that walk without us. My account of the details is as clear as you think, kept up by friends that still ask about us. If our lives were a movie, if our lives were a book, it'd be longer than I'd recommend. 'Cause if you're telling a story, at some point you stop. But stories don't end.
For Taylor Goldsmith, communication, connection, is always elusive. This album is loaded with lyrics about how people don't hear the sentiments beneath a conversation, how the person to whom Taylor most wants to express his affection is ignoring him, or is looking for love from someone else. A key lyric in the song Most People is, "Most people don't talk enough about how lucky they are." And in another tune, Someone Will, the music that surrounds his words is frequently spare. But it's also music that can rise up and around the verses to breathe additional life into the singer's fading romantic hopes.
Grab your cigarettes and follow me out of the living room. I'll get drunk enough to tell you how I feel about the men you love and how they all seem to get the best of you. 'Cause if I don't say these things, you know someone will. If that look.
I admire bands that can capture not just big universal emotions and ideas, but also little, specific, tricky ones. Dawes crafts songs about the shifts of mood and attitude between two people by approaching them from different angles, by doing the musical equivalent of sidling up to them and eavesdropping, and then transforming that found material into their art. That's what Dawes manages on the frequent best moments of Stories Don't End.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. Coming up, actress and filmmaker Sarah Polley on her new documentary, Stories We Tell. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Can you describe the whole story from the beginning until now in your own words?
What? Wow. I guess I better pee first.
That was the Canadian actress and director Sarah Polley asking what she asked of her family members and friends. Tell the story of her mother as they remember her. It was her way of learning about her mother, Diane, who died when Sarah was only 11. Those interviews are interwoven in Sarah Polley's new documentary, Stories We Tell. She discovers her mother died with a secret. Sarah's father, the actor Michael Polley, was not Sarah's biological father. The film reflects on how her mother was perceived differently by each person who knew her, and it considers what changed and what didn't when the secret was uncovered. Stories We Tell won the Toronto Film Critics Association Award for Best Canadian Film. The first time Sarah Polley won that award was in 2006 for her film Away From Her. Polley has acted in the films The Sweet Hereafter, My Life Without Me, and Exotica. She spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Here's another excerpt of Stories We Tell, in which her family members discuss how she never looked like her father, Michael Polley, who raised her. We hear from him first, then siblings Joanna, John, and Mark.
So at some point, because we used to often have dinner together on weekends, probably Johnny started by saying, "You don't look much like your father."
I think it was Johnny. I want to say it was Johnny. And actually now in retrospect that I know that Johnny was the first of us who knew, it must have been Johnny.
I stupidly mentioned it to Mark, I thought.
My lawyer has said I don't have to talk to you, and so I'm not going to say anything more. I remember Johnny saying that someone thought that your father might be someone that Mom had acted with in a play.
And I told them not to say anything to anyone, but then they turned it into a joke. And I did not participate in the joke, did I? I don't think I ever did.
I remember we talked about how you didn't look like Dad, and Dad joked about it.
I always thought, she does look like me. Got that little straight nose. Yeah, definitely. This is all nonsense, but it's fun. Who do you think your father is this week, Sarah?
Sarah Polley, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi there.
So I really think you achieve in this movie what fiction strives for, which is complex human stories that make you think about human nature, about the complexities of relationships, and how everyone has their own version of reality, except that your story is true. let's talk a little bit about that story. Your siblings had heard rumors and jokes about your father not really being your biological father. Did those rumors ever filter down to you when your mother was alive? She died when you were 11.
You know, the rumors and the jokes really started after she had died. And, you know, my family, the sense of humor in my family has always been a little bit dark. There's no sacred cows. There's no taboos. So, you know, as much as it doesn't sound very funny, probably in the context of another family, in my family it was completely normal to joke about this kind of thing. And I just took it as a joke. But over the years, I started to wonder if there was maybe more truth to that rumor.
You have everybody telling their story, and the stories, some of those stories are contradictory of other stories. But the person who turns out to be your biological father, he doesn't want other people's stories. He feels like he owns that story. Only he and your mother know about what happened between them, and that everybody else's story is kind of like secondary. They're bystanders. They're minor characters. And like, he should be the one who owns the story. What was your response to that?
Well, I think what he talks about in the film, which I think he talks about very eloquently, is that the crucial function of art is to tell the truth, and that the only people who can really tell the story of him and my mother's relationship is him, and, you know, only one of them is left living, and it's him. And I think he's right. And in a way, in the film, he is the only person who tells that part of the story. I mean, there are other people peppering it with comments, but basically he does tell us, you know, that story, probably not as completely as, you know, he would have if he had made his own film about it. But his voice is the one that tells that story. But I really loved that essential, in a way, disagreement in terms of a worldview of my father and my biological father, of whether or not you can know the truth in the past, and whether or not you can get close to it, and whether you can reconstruct the past, and whether memory is reliable. And I mean, I don't think it's like a black and white disagreement, but I think that for me was a really interesting tension in the film.
So even though you didn't want the movie to just be you exposing your story, I just really want to know, when you found out that your mother had kept this secret from you, from your father, and from your biological father, did you feel betrayed? Did you feel like you were all treated unfairly?
I didn't, actually. I don't think she kept it a secret from my biological father, but certainly from my father and I and the rest of my family. To be honest, I don't see what the point would have been at telling me when I was a child. I mean, I was growing up as a member of the Polly family, and I'm not sure what the point would have been in adding all this confusion. I think I found out about it at the perfect age when I was 27, when, you know, you're not still in that kind of adolescent forming yourself, completely vulnerable stage of life where something like this would be a real trauma, I think, to find out. So I never felt betrayed, and I certainly never felt angry.
You decided to tell your father that he was not your biological father. Was that a tough choice to make?
Yes, and it wasn't a choice I wanted to make. I think that I had decided pretty firmly to not tell him for the same reason, sort of not being able to see the point of crashing that information on somebody. But a couple of journalists, or one journalist in particular in Toronto, had heard the story and was going to print it. He ended up agreeing not to print it, but I realized at that moment that, you know, my father was in danger of finding this information out in a newspaper, and I certainly wanted to prevent that being the way he would hear it.
How did you figure out what the right way to tell him would be, what the most gentle way of telling him would be?
It was pretty impossible. I mean, to be honest, I was sort of at that stage really filled with regret that I had ever investigated this at all, and felt enormously guilty in a way that almost sank me. And it took a friend of mine to actually point out to me that by discovering this information, I hadn't actually created the situation or, you know, done anything particularly wrong. But it was hard to come to terms with that because I felt that I was in possession of information that would be really traumatic and hurtful for him and would destroy him. And so I told him as honestly and clearly as I could, and then was completely staggered and stunned by his response to it, which was so full of compassion for my mother and gentleness and graciousness. And I think in a way his response to this information was for me what made it a really interesting story.
So since we're discussing here how your father handled the news, I want to play a clip from your movie Stories We Tell, in which he actually reads an email that he sent you explaining to you how he felt about it. And it is so compassionate, so full of understanding for your mother who had this affair, and so full of love for you, love unchanged by knowing that he is really not your biological father. So this is the email. Here he is reading the email that he wrote you, and this is from Sarah Polley's documentary Stories We Tell.
So don't feel sorry for me. If you have pity, it should be for Harry, who loved and lost Diane, and then missed out on the childhood of that Sarah he'd produced. Had that been my lot, I would have been mortified when I read that DNA result. I've been a very lucky man, and of course, for one of my luckiest moments, I have to thank Harry Gulking for loving Diane. Sarah is only what she is because of that night of love between Diane and Harry. Had I been her biological father, she would have been entirely different. She might have been better or worse, but she would definitely not have been the Sarah she is today. And that's the one I love. Of the other possible outcome, there's nothing. You may decide you want to keep this letter to yourself or to share it. It's yours and yours the choice. You know, look.
Dad, can you just go back over that one line?
I was being so real. I completely convinced myself. You may decide you want to keep this letter to yourself or to share it. It's yours and yours the choice. You know, look. While telling me your news on Thursday, you twice hugged me as hard as you ever did in your childhood. That alone made your revelation worth a thousand words.
Oh, I love that section, Sarah Polley, because, first of all, the letter your father wrote you is just, as you said, so full of compassion. It's such a beautiful expression of love for you and of compassion and forgiveness for your mother. Do you remember when you received this letter and first read it?
I do, yeah. I remember just being floored by it. It was within 24 hours of him finding out that he was not my biological father, that he came to that and came to sending us this email saying, you know, our marriage was not a perfect one and there are things that I know your mother said she needed in the marriage that I see now she desperately needed and I did not provide. And his first concern was for her and that we not blame her or change our feelings or impression of her. And then also real concern for me and the fact that I had felt that I had to keep this secret or that he couldn't handle it. So it was very inspiring and obviously really unexpected.
So I'm going to pause here. I love your father. I mean, I know him from the movie and from seeing him on the Canadian show Slings and Arrows, which was just a wonderful, if you haven't seen it, I really recommend it, our listeners. It's a wonderful series about a small drama company in Canada. So he's one of like the older actors in this acting company who always gets like minor roles. But at the end of the episode, he sings a song as the credits roll. And I just want to play the song that he sings. It's called Call My Understudy.
Call the understudy. I can't go on tonight. I'm drinking with my buddy. I'm getting good and tight. Before they raise the curtain, I'll be higher than a kite. So call the understudy. I can't go on tonight. Tell the cast and crew to break a leg. Break a leg. Roll me out and up the bloody keg. Bloody keg. Hiding to ease the pain that life can bring.
Life can bring.
And liquor is what will hit the spot. The play is not the thing. So call the understudy. I think it's only
that's Michael Polly, my guest Sarah Polly's father, singing the closing song from the Canadian series Slings and Arrows, which was shown in America on Sundance and is on DVD. But anyways, you know, so your father is an actor. Your mother was an actress. But my understanding from the film is that your father basically gave up acting to earn a steady living to help support the family.
Yeah, so he was an actor until, I guess, his 30s. And then he had his first kid, my brother Mark, and, you know, got a job in an insurance company to support the family. And then I think it was after he retired that he started to go back to acting and I think got some of the most, you know, interesting parts he had played.
He strikes me as someone who really has acting in his blood and who just knows so much about theater. There's just like little clues about that in your documentary.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, he was the kind of person, I mean, I'm totally not this kind of actor, so I've always been in awe of this, where, you know, when you'd see my dad on stage, he was the kind of person who could just fill a theater. Like, his presence was so kind of robust and big, and he was so arresting. And it's always been a mystery to me how somebody creates that kind of huge life, you know, on a stage.
But this leads to something so interesting about the chemistry between your father and your mother. He says they acted in a play together, which is how they met and started their relationship. And he thinks that your mother fell in love with the character he was playing because that was like a big character. And he thought that they were such different people, that your mother was kind of theatrical and extroverted and he was so like introverted and private, and, you know, she had all this energy and libido and he just like, he didn't.
Well, and he talks about, I think, you know, that he felt that he had sort of disappointed her, that he wasn't, you know, as huge, as larger and than life. And, you know, he's playing Mick in The Caretaker, which is this very, very big character, and that's who she fell in love with and not really him. I'm not sure if I agree with that, but I think that, you know, it is interesting and complicated, I think, when actors fall in love, especially when they're playing other people.
I don't know if you're one of those people who have like traced their family tree to see like what is my family history. But you know what you thought your family tree was, if you ever thought about it, is different blood-wise than you would have initially thought.
Yeah, and that is really interesting. And it's funny because it's, you know, my dad who kind of like encouraged me to, you know more about your biological father's family because it sounds so fascinating. I mean, they were Russian Jews who fought in the Russian Revolution and, you know, had to escape the Ukraine when the Polish invading armies came in. And there's an amazing story there. My dad's kind of like oh my God, like, you know, your blood is so much more interesting than it was. Like, you've got to look into, you know, you've got to look into Jewish culture. You've got to look into Russian culture. Like, this is amazing. And my, you know, my siblings are, you're totally traded up in terms of genes. You traded up. So, I mean, I've definitely had a lot of encouragement from the family who raised me to be interested in that. And to be, you know, inquisitive about it. So it's interesting, and it is important to a certain extent. And I'm glad to be able to tell, you know, my kids about that. But I'm not sure that it in any way supersedes how important it was in terms of the family I grew up with and how I was raised. And I think that has ultimately made me who I am more than anything.
The film is about finding out who your biological father is, but you also really learned a lot about your mother. You know, as I said, she died when you were 11, so there's a limit to what you could have known about her because you were too young to understand any adult in their complexity. So what, like hearing different people from your family, hearing your mother's friends, hearing all those people like talk about her, what are some of the holes in her personality and her life that were filled in for you?
I think a lot. I think it's hard to articulate exactly what, but just, you know, having the opportunity to sit with most of the people that your mother was close to in her life and get to hear them talk about her ends up forming a much more full picture than the one I had before. At the same time, even though I wasn't an adult and didn't get to know, you know, the complexity of who she was, I had somebody say to me once years ago, they were asking me, you know, what was your mother like? And I said, I don't know. She died when I was 11. And she said, well, what did she feel like? And that was an amazing window for me into the idea that I did know her, that you don't actually have to be able to articulate or intellectually know who somebody is to really know them. And that, you know, 11 years is actually a really long time, especially to have a really good mother. And it's more than most people get, you know, and I had until I was 11 years old, a mother who made me feel like life was really exciting, that she loved us, that she could find joy even when life had been tragic. And that's so much more than most people get, that I feel incredibly grateful for that. And then obviously so privileged to have been able to add all of this new information to that picture.
Well, I want to say, after we've talked, our listeners might assume that we've given away all the secrets of your movie stories we tell, and we haven't. So, so you know, thank you so much for talking with us, and
thank you.
Congratulations on the movie.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Polley spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Polley's new documentary about her family is called Stories We Tell. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Saman, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.